nest of terrorists. Only the bleeding-heart liberal traitors have kept our forces from wiping them out.
The ebony-skinned woman standing beside Shia stared bleakly at the black screen. Anya's glance at her was quick and tight-lipped. Her name was Isis. She had last seen her lying in the muck on the floor of the death hut in the Gold Camp colony after Anya had just broken her jaw. She was cleaned up considerably, strikingly beautiful, and obviously Promacin healing techniques had served her as well as they had Anya. She was visibly struggling to contain her anger.
I'm sorry, but I've no control over what our media say.
But you do bear responsibility. You've brought their attention upon us, not to mention the attentions of the armored cars and strike airplanes of the Brazilian armed forces, which are even less welcome.
Yes, I thought I was doing the right thing.
And you feel that excuses what you actually did, your pious intentions?
Please, Isis, don't badger my guest.
I apologize to you both for allowing my self-control to slip. I will leave you now.
I'm sorry, Anya. I hope she will forgive you. It appears she has more of that particular spiritual path to walk yet. You killed her lover, Huatzi Nest, the man who visited you in your hotel in Belém to try to warn you away. I know. Patrocínio killed your lover in Files Lusitania as well. You killed several of us in Manaus and the Gold Camp. You wonder why we would forgive you. You wonder why you don't hate us.
Yes.
We'll try to make it clear to you. Soon.
Anya rose and walked out onto the balcony. She stepped out into a bright morning nowhere near as muggy as she'd expected. The city spread out before her. The first surprise, when she had finally mustered the strength to get out of bed that morning and peer out the balcony doors, was that it had levels. Not just multi-story buildings, but actual relief. That struck Anya as unusual. The Amazon basin downstream from the Andean foothills was flat as prairie farmland. Moreover, the water table was so high it was hard to build anything lasting. The plantation house and attached chapel had presumably been constructed on enormously deep foundations of stone or concrete. In a few decades, they'd show signs of serious sinkage into the underlying muck. To build an entire city was remarkable. In front of Anya's building lay a large, sunken plaza. Its terraced levels followed flowing, organic contours, rather than the usual strict rectilinear lines of most city squares she'd seen. Fountains sprayed in broad pools. Masses of greenery formed irregular islands in the multi-layered pavement. There were so many brightly colored flower patches that it looked at first glance as if the city had been bombarded with paint balloons from orbit. She saw no vehicles. Plenty of people walked about or simply sat on benches and fountain rims. Dozens of children, mostly wearing brightly colored smocks, raced here and there among the adult pedestrians. The buildings themselves particularly fascinated her. Their walls seemed slightly sloped, though the general pattern suggested Mesoamerican architecture. Some buildings incorporated or were themselves outright step pyramids, the buildings truncated and broad-topped. The structures that crowned some buildings came to near points. She saw rounded features as well, with appearances like towers of a medieval castle. The city had a more graceful, less oppressive aspect than most excavated Central American buildings she had seen. The ancient Indians had been constrained by the limitations of available building materials and by the fact that the rulers who built the great public structures wanted them to be oppressive, to remind all who saw them, whether potential invaders or their own subjects, just who was boss. She also thought she saw elements, strangely, of Nepalese and Tibetan architecture in the odd dome or stepped tower or building with pagoda-like sweeps to the eaves. Disparate as the elements were, all fit together with wonderful harmony.
It's beautiful. It looks like nowhere else on Earth.
It reflects our influences. The tribal cultures of Africa and Amazonia, the scientific and rationalistic cultures of the West, the spiritual learning and millennia-old science that Westerners always like to overlook, of India and China.
How is that possible?
From our very inception, our predecessors realized the value of information. So we have spent centuries gathering all we can, either by researching it ourselves or trading for it with others. We take what serves us and use it. Come, Anya. Let's get out in it. You can stand to stretch your legs.
That's the truth.
They found Patricinio in front of the building, which seemed to be a sort of dormitory or apartment. He stood by a fountain surrounded by children. He held a little boy up in the air, and when he saw Anya and Shia, he smiled happily and put the child down, tousling his hair.
Thank you. Now, I have to go play with my other friends.
Okay.
Anya, Patricinio, and Shia began walking down into the sunken plaza.
Why did you thank that boy?
For sharing his laughter with me.
It was sweet of you to take the time to play with them.
It's part of my job.
It helps to realize that along with playing, he was teaching them basic physical science concepts. Here we teach our children from the start to regard learning as a form of play, rather than making it into a form of torture, the way they do in your world. But then, the goal where you come from is to instill habits of obedience. And after all, an eager curiosity and propensity to ask questions is quite counterproductive from that outlook, isn't it? Now, you've got many questions, and we haven't got much time. Ask them, Anya.
You always seem to be armed. Is there danger to defend against on the streets of Promesa?
There's danger everywhere humans are, Anya. Surely you of all people know that.
It is a tradition with practical roots. We had to fight to escape. We had to fight to stay free. We had to fight to survive. And after 3 centuries, we must fight the greatest danger in our history.
We're no pacifists. I know you've noticed that.
Did you kill Mafalda?
Not personally. Did Promesans kill her? Yes.
And if you wonder whether we approve of the killing, our reluctant answer would be yes.
But what was she doing to you?
It was what she had done. She betrayed some of our people abroad, sold them. They had to commit suicide to escape torture. Publico is not the first or only party to learn enough of our secrets to be willing to use extreme measures to learn more.
And the man in Feliz Lusitania?
We went to bring him home, not kill him. He was exiled for certain crimes, but none so dire that he be denied the mercy of dying among friends.
Most people who leave the city do so because they choose not to participate in our culture. The tiny number who are exiled submit to having their memory suppressed, as do most outsiders allowed to visit here, as Reinhard Lindmüller did.
Advanced as our mind science is, it isn't perfect. Sometimes the conditioning sleeps. Thus with our brother's dreams in Feliz Lusitania.
Why do you even take the risks of dealing with the outside world, then?
Trade both in goods and ideas as our lifeblood, as it is of all humankind.
And it's a means whereby we can parcel our knowledge out to humankind as a whole, against the resistance of the powerful of the world, whose political and monetary power are based upon scarcity.
You mean you're not deliberately withholding your knowledge? That's what Sirian believes.
Is it? Don't you suspect he knows exactly what the truth is?
Yes, I guess I do. He told me at the airstrip just before he tried to kill me. He wanted your secrets to bring himself power.
Anya, information is more than just a commodity to us. It's life. It's always been our life, our mainstay, as well as the source of our wealth. In the first days, when our ancestors ran away from their self-proclaimed owners, our brothers and sisters, taken from the cities of West Africa, pooled their knowledge of the arts of civilization. Their tribal cousins contributed knowledge of warfare and survival, the arts of wilderness. Later, we traded our knowledge with other Indians in exchange for theirs.
What about the Indians? Didn't they regard you as invaders?
Some did. And in truth, not all of our ancestors were eager to embrace them. Bigotry is a many-headed beast, and no people has a monopoly on it, or lacks it completely. Still, necessity forced us to learn to get along with the natives of the land. Eventually, we began to meld together.
You never fought them?
Sometimes we did, especially those of us driven from Palmeiras in 1694. After our Dutch trading partners betrayed us to our masters, the pioneers who founded the Colombo dos Sonhos, determined to put as much space as possible between themselves and the colonials. as they pushed to the river, some of the tribes contested their passage. Though they tried to keep to the river as much as possible and make no mark.
What about the Indians here?
Our ancestors sought a completely receptive environment. The land, the water, the creatures, and the people. We found the proper combination here. The local tribes agreed to cede us land in return for our protection and our knowledge. The arrangement continues to this day.
I've got a lot to learn.
Yes, and not much time to learn it. So why not go ahead and ask the question that's really on your mind?
Such as why you do not hate me. For which I am thankful, by the way.
I'll play the bad guy, Anya, and tell you the truth about your friend Dan. He branched out early on from violent street protest into extortion and the odd assassination. The latter came after Sir Ian scooped him up and provided an advanced training. He was an apt pupil, you might say. As Moran told you, Dan was his troubleshooter. I gather he didn't fill in many details. Among other things, despite his youth, Dan served as an advisor in such matters as the campaign of genocide against nomadic peoples waged by certain African governments with the complicity of the UN and the West. Not unlike the way the Brazilian government is trying to destroy the Indians of Amazonas and us by wiping out the rainforest upon which we all depend for survival.
Anya walked between the magnificent buildings, hugging herself tightly. Her reflex was to reject all this information as slander. Still, she knew that she had noticed something off about Dan from the very beginning.
He was a good man, in his way.
But too angry.
But why? Why would he take part in mass murder?
He did care deeply about his fellow humans, I think. But he saw what they were capable of doing to each other, and it disgusted and confused him. It became easy for him to rationalize anything, as long as he believed it served his cause. I think that was largely what Sir Ian told him it should be.
So you're saying he did terrible things because he was a good man?
The passionate best, or those who believe they know best, always commit the greatest crimes. For those who believe they serve some ultimate good, the sky's the limit.
I regret that it came to pass that he and I fought. In that we did, I do not regret I killed him.
I understand. I feel the same way about the people I killed. Why don't you hate me for killing your friends?
Some of us do. Isis isn't alone.
Anya, we each walk our own path. Those whom you killed accepted the possibility of their deaths the instant they set upon the path of a warrior.
As for responsibility for their deaths, we bear our own share. We chose to bring you here.
You're saying you influenced Sir Ian to hire me?
Not at all. Once we knew he had recruited you, though, we made our decision. Shea, myself, certain others in the city, you have the potential to be an enormous force for good in the world, Anya. You carry the sword. We wanted to help you learn a bit about what that means. We also wish to try to show you how to avoid certain pitfalls.
If it seems as if Patricinio is skating around the subject, it is because he doesn't want to point out just how easy it would be for the sword to turn you into a monster.
I know. There were times on this journey... Wait. You set this up as a test, didn't you?
You had to earn your way here, Anya. If we gave you gifts without your proving worthy, we would compromise not just your destiny, but our own.
So you set up your own people for me to kill as a means of testing me?
Blame me if it makes you feel better.
You weren't the only one being tested, Anya. Those whom you fought had their own tests to pass. Some did not. If that horrifies you, it saddens me. But so be it. We did not survive this long by making things easy on ourselves. Don't let our beautiful surroundings mislead you. We have provided comfort for ourselves. That is part of the reason we must continually test our abilities. That, and the desire to expand our understanding.
They had halted by another fountain. Anya walked a few paces away from her escorts. Her thoughts were a turmoil. She was fighting against a feeling of overwhelming relief combined with guilt. She sat down on the lip of the fountain and put her head in her hands. Patricinho put his hand on her shoulder.
Now, Anya, let us do what we can while we can.
The forest and fields were quiet after a day of hit-and-run battles between the Promesans and the Brazilian forces Publico had brought in. Anya could only wonder what the escalating war would do to Publico's peace activist image. As far as she could imagine, nothing. If word of his involvement ever got out, which was doubtful in itself, Sir Ian Moran employed phalanxes of expert spin doctors. For evidence, she had only to recall the news broadcasts Shia had shown her several days earlier. Never had she heard mention of his name.
Anya, do you hear? It's an attack airplane. They're flying out of a base near Lake Ayama.
That sounds like a propeller plane.
It is.
You're kidding! I thought Brazil had a pretty modern air force.
It's the very latest thing in the Brazilian Air Force. An Embraer ALX light attack fighter variant of the Super Tucano.
You sound like an enthusiast.
A girl has her hobbies, even in Promesa.
Don't they use jets?
They're mostly too fast. Prop planes can fly slow enough to really see and hit smaller ground targets like us. This aircraft is designed to murder helpless native people on the ground, such as so-called insurgents, guerrillas, and bandits.
Well, the natives can't be too helpless. You shot it down. Was that some kind of death beam?
Actually, it was a shoulder-launched portable air defense missile. Russian-made.
We're using our energy hand weapons sparingly, because they're not really anything that couldn't be duplicated, and we don't want to announce to the world that we have super technology just waiting to be plundered. It would be a feeding frenzy.
And that would be why we're off on a good old-fashioned decapitation strike.
Anya was unsure how far they had hiked. She knew Promesa lay well inland of the main river, although lesser streams cut through the land as they did most of the whole basin. She guessed it was at least 20 miles away. She didn't know the Quilombo's full size. Shia and Patricinho and the others she had met in the past few days had smilingly refused to answer questions about specific locations. Along with Anya and Shia and Patricinho, the group included Bert, a stocky and round-faced Asian-looking man with his hair in a long queue down his back, a pair of young women, Lise and Julia, and six others. Lise was blonde and slender, a few inches shorter than Anya. She spoke with what sounded to Anya like a Midwest American accent. Julia was average height, sturdy and broad-shouldered, brown-skinned and eyed, and with short black hair. Everyone was dressed in practical combat gear. She was told the specially developed fabric used the wearer's own metabolic energy to optimize their body temperature. It was also waterproof, as the armorer explained as they were fitted for the suits. Likewise, the combat suit resisted cuts, fire, and even bullets, though it was far from bulletproof. The clothing reduced the wearer's heat signature, although since the team wasn't using any kind of face masks or shielding, infrared detectors would see their heads as bright balloons bobbing above the ground. No one else seemed bothered by that, so Anya chose not to worry about it either. A lot was not being explained to her, she knew. Some was because she didn't have the reference for it. Some was because what she didn't know, she couldn't tell. She had not been taught the willed suicide technique of the Promesans. Her head had been stuffed too full of knowledge in too short a time as it was, and she wasn't even sure how she felt ethically about using it. For the same reason, she had also refused any kind of suicide pill. She hoped she didn't regret it. If Publico thought she had any information that might serve him, she didn't doubt he was capable of handing her over to his local allies for torture. She also refused the treatment some Promesans going out in the world took. The chemical injection turned their bodies into incendiaries or bombs in case of death. Watsin Nest, Isis's lover, whom Anya had killed, had taken the former route. Upon his death, his body had spontaneously combusted and burned Mafalda's shop to the ground. Anya had to admit part of her found that idea appealing, but she'd never be able to rest for fear the stuff would accidentally go off while she was still alive, or even cause her to die of some horrid, hitherto unknown cancer 10 or 15 years down the line. All of the team wore harnesses of some dark, tough synthetic over their midnight suits, with light packs on their backs. Each carried a weapon that vaguely resembled a modern bullpup carbine. Over each Promason's shoulder rose the hilt of a short sword. What had seemed from a distance to be a derelict field turned out to be a bog. Warm water rose to just above Anya's ankles. It made her very glad for their special suits. She knew what kind of things lived in the Amazonian waters. Not that the creatures crawling through the leaf litter ubiquitous on more solid land were any friendlier or more reassuring.
And here I was thinking you two were otherworldly spiritual types.
And did we give you that impression the last couple of days? Forgive us, please. The spiritual part of what we had to teach you in such short time was the greater. Your physical skills are already superb.
Haven't you figured it out yet? We're in the same business as you, Anya. Defenders. Physical combat in all its aspects is only part of our jobs. But it is a major part. And like anyone you're likely to encounter among us, the jobs we do are the ones we're most attuned to.
20mm machine cannon.
The team of 12 advanced into more dense forest. Divided into two squads, they walked roughly parallel, staggered so that no one walked exactly behind the person in front, apparently to reduce the likelihood of a single burst of gunfire that would take them all out at once. Anya was in the middle of her group, with Patricinio's comforting presence behind her, and Lys in front. Each of the midnight suits had a small panel on the breastbone and between the shoulder blades that glowed faintly, a different color for each team member. The others had laughed at Anya's alarm at having an illuminated target right over her heart, front and back. No one not on the team, Bert explained, could see the panels. How that was even possible, Anya had no clue. The Promasons offered no explanation. Isis led the second group. Despite her barely shielded enmity toward Anya, she had to admit that the dark-skinned woman seemed quietly competent. The chief of the strike team was named Marco. Instead of the harness the others wore, he sported a web utility belt heavily loaded down with instruments. Shea held up her hand. A small figure materialized ahead as a shadow right by her left elbow. The figure grinned at her with teeth bright white in a black-painted face. He was no taller than Anya's shoulder, with a bowl haircut and a skimpy loincloth. He also had a Kalashnikov assault rifle, almost as long as he was tall. The small, nearly naked Indian suddenly crouched beside her, putting his ear up to her mouth. Then, as quickly as he had appeared, he became one with the night. Shea turned back, beckoning the others to gather near.
We've got our allies passing word we're coming through so they don't bushwhack us. They say the invaders are patrolling very aggressively.
Aren't they bushwhacking them?
The commander is showing the degree of regard for human life you'd expect. They care about their own troops only a little more than they do about us. The only real difference is they actively want us dead.
So it is in the third world. Life isn't cheap to the people. It's the rulers who don't value the people's lives. They must be getting ready to make a big push.
At the night? No way.
Not our concern. We just have to be ready for anything.
Anya was beginning to notice flashes of light and even tracers arcing against the sky. She couldn't tell how much, if any, came from the defenders, but it was clear that the situation was intensifying by the moment. As she had seen from the mercenaries' response to Billy's killing on the boat, the invaders let off rounds in truckloads. Whether this was to suppress and kill suspected enemies or just make themselves feel better, she didn't know. It occurred to her that her group risked getting hit purely by accident. As time went on, Anya could no longer see visible signs of the battle. The invaders were pushing to the west-northwest, angling inland from the river, while Shea had led her infiltration team north and east, swinging wide around the main thrust. Now they turned back toward the river and the headquarters the Brazilian commander shared with Sir Ian and his men. The squads had separated, adding a little more distance between the two, so one or the other could flank any prospective attacker. Shea raised her hand. Her five followers sank into a stand of brush, though Isis continued forward. Anya raised her rifle and snugged its padded butt to her shoulder. She peered through her sights. Her carbine fired semi or full automatic, and quite silently either way. It reloaded from the top with blocks of 50 projectiles. The chief armorer told Anya the rifles used electromagnetism, whatever that meant in this context. Atop her rifle, conventional night sights glowed ghostly in the darkness. With just a flick of her right thumb, she was provided with infrared vision. At once, she saw big blobs of yellow so bright they were almost white right ahead.
Isis, get down!
Helpless, Anya watched as a pair of Isis's squad members, silhouetted against a colossal muzzle flare, were shredded by the machine cannon burst. The rest of the armored car's 20-millimeter shells flew over the heads of Anya's squad to rake the jungle line 40 yards behind them. Lesser flashes lit the night as soldiers fired their assault rifles. More machine cannon fire was coming from a second armored car, opened up from 30 yards or so to the left of the first.
Stay down, Anya. They're not shooting at us.
Patricinha was right. The shots all passed over the heads of the now totally prone Promason team. Isis's two people had been blown away by a cruel accident, by a foe who had no idea they were even there. A brilliant flash lit the wedge-shaped snout of the vehicle that had shot up Isis's team. An orange flame roared from the drivers and cupola hatches. A figure wrapped in flames climbed from the cupola, fell to the ground, and rolled.
Here they come! Stay low and don't move unless you have to!
In the garish light of the flames, Anya saw soldiers following the two surviving armored cars. They came toward her, heads hunched forward beneath their camo-mottled boonie hats, prodding the night before them with their rifles. One man came so near to Anya, she might have grabbed his right ankle as he went by. She tried to remember the lessons Shia and Patricinha had given her the past 2 days on stealth. Try to think as little as possible. See yourself as part of the landscape. Never look directly at an enemy. He'll sense you. Anya lay quivering. She felt a touch on her shoulder.
Easy, easy, Anya. You're okay, yes?
Shaken, but alive.
Then let's go. We're almost to the real danger.
The 10 surviving members of the two squads moved on. The Indians, who had ambushed the soldiers with an anti-tank rocket and rifle fire, had long since melted into the jungle. They crouched down as they caught sight of the nimbus of light above the trees cast by the base camp the invaders had established near the ruined plantation house. It marked their objective. There waited Publico and the Brazilian army officer in command. And there also lay tents and trailers containing the invaders' command and communications gear, as well as stations monitoring the enemy's sensors. If the Promasons and Anya could destroy that equipment and kill the leaders, the whole invasion would lose momentum and quickly become bogged down. Anya didn't believe that could win them any more than a temporary reprieve. But her friends assured her that a little breathing room was all they needed to secure the safety of their city and its tribal allies. All she could do was swallow her doubts and do her best. Anya crouched beside the fence encircling the invaders' base. Within, no searchlights moved. The banks of generator-fed lights, though bright, were spottily placed, leaving plentiful shadow pools for them to skulk through, once they got inside, at least.
What about this fence, Patricinha? You forgot to teach me to levitate.
That's the advanced course. Luckily for you, we don't go over. We go through.
He reached behind himself and withdrew wire cutters from his pack.
After you, Anya. We'll fold it back in place once we're through.
Got it.
Bent over, Anya slipped through the instant gateway in the chain link. She kept her weapon at the ready, scanning back and forth as she slipped right toward the cover of a tent, obviously protecting a stack of supplies. She had no qualms about using her sword. Any survivors of tonight's bloody work would have memories so confused and chaotic that no one would believe any wild tales they might tell about a tall white woman wielding a broadsword like an avenging angel. It was one factor she had found worked consistently in her favor. The human mind saw mainly what it expected to see and overlooked or edited out what didn't fit. But the sword was a weapon for face-to-face combat. If she had to engage any guards at a distance, she wanted to be able to just shoot them. Her Promason weapon fired silently. She could only hope that her targets died the same way. The team coalesced, then split into two groups. Shia took Bert and a woman named Reed and went off circling the wire perimeter to the left to infiltrate closer to the river. The compound had grown up inland, not on the Amazon bank. The landing area had been transformed into a separate compound that was ablaze with light day and night, so supplies could be unloaded from relatively fast diesel riverboats. Likewise, the bigger airstrip was blasted from the jungle and improved with perforated steel plating to allow cargo planes to fly in and out. Shia's group was to destroy the generators and the trailers where surveillance and communications were processed. Marco moved out towards the chapel, his wonders to perform. The other six survivors had been split into two fire teams of three each. They would attempt to hit the command tent, which was in the center of the several-acre compound, from two directions simultaneously. The plan seemed hopelessly ambitious, but Anya was determined to try, and die if necessary. The thought of what Publico would do if he succeeded was all she needed to keep her going. Anya trotted in a crouch up to the supply tent and squatted. A moment later, Shingu and Isis joined her. As promised, Patricinio had smoothed the slashed wire back into place so deftly that Anya couldn't see the cut from a few yards away. He took Lise and Julia and vanished into shadows to the left. Isis clearly commanded this team. She acknowledged Anya with a simple nod. Whatever enmity Isis harbored in her heart toward her, Anya felt confident it would in no way affect what she did here inside the wire. They slipped to the tent's far end. Isis poked her head around for a quick lookout, then gestured for Shingu and Anya to advance while she covered. With Shingu on her right, Anya moved into the open. There was still shadow, thanks to the haphazard placement of the lights, but she felt exposed anyway. Worse, they would have to transit a good 10 yards of brightly lit open space to reach the huge multi-room tent, where Publico, according to their Indian spies, held court. Shingu suddenly held up his hand, and both he and Anya froze. Shingu carried two projectile weapons. Slung behind his back, barrel down for ready access, rode his compact electromagnetic rifle. He held a second weapon, about half its size and with a single pistol grip, in both hands. It had a bulbous body and a long, narrow barrel. He snugged it to his shoulder and aimed it toward whoever was approaching. Two men in camis strolled out from around the corner of another tent 10 yards away. Anya was amazed at their sloppiness. They didn't even glance toward her and Shingu, who lay in the open, crouched in plain view. Shingu's shot hit the man on the right in the throat, and the mercenary dropped instantly to the ground. The other faltered in mid-step. Anya could see the look of baffled surprise come onto his lean young features. He started to turn, reaching clumsily for the M16 slung over his own shoulder. Shingu's next shot struck the survivor under the right ear. He folded like an empty raincoat.
Gorare. Fast to death.
Why don't we just use that then?
Cloth stops darts. Have to hit skin.
Shingu and Anya scuttled for the cover of the nearby tent. They held their position as Isis ghosted on right and inward to a pile of crates covered with olive drab tarps. They kept working their way toward the command pavilion. Such action as was visible was all going on to the riverside of the camp, where a stream of trucks came through the gate and offloaded. As Anya and Shingu darted around the end of a darkened tent, Anya dared hope they'd make it undetected. The door to a latrine to the right opened, and a geeky guy with glasses came out, fiddling with the fly of his camo pants. His eyes and mouth flew wide.
Alarme! Alarme! Alarme!
Shingu hit the mercenary in the open mouth with the curare darts from his high-tech blowgun, but by then it was too late, of course. Anya darted for the cover of the latrine, a long shack walled with what looked like prefab fence sections. It had a slanting roof made of corrugated tin. Anya was smashed with a tremendous impact, but knew immediately that she had been at least partially shielded from the true force of the blast. A lithe, strong body had hit her in a flying tackle, and as Anya rolled over, ready for defensive or life-saving action, she came face to face with Isis. The woman was sprawled out on her back limply, seemingly twisted by the explosion's concussion. The anthracite eyes focused on Anya's face.
Do what you must.
Anya's heart fell into her stomach as Isis's head lolled to the side in death. Looking up through tears that threatened to blind her, Anya saw Shingu running to her, firing his electronic rifle toward where the terrific light and noise had come from. She expected to see the man shot down. Instead, he dived down beside her intact. Anya low-crawled to the corner of the latrine to risk a look around. 15 yards away, a Hummer was going up in flames. The heavy-mounted machine gun sprouting from its roof was tipped uselessly toward the sky. Fire jetted straight up through the mount. Men bailed out the doors, shrouded in flames. Anya dropped to her belly and stuck her electromagnetic rifle out with her left hand. She ducked back and looked at Shingu.
What did you do to that Hummer?
My rifle. Shoots explosive shells, too.
Anya got up on her haunches, transferring the rifle back to her right hand. She looked down at the fallen Isis. The woman seemed to be completely at peace. She had fought her best and died the death she had chosen. In a strange way, her fate could even be envied. Anya reached down her left hand and closed the staring eyes with a quick motion of her first two fingers.
Shingu, we have to go.
Agreed.
The camp was alive with action, with the battle taking on the feeling of a free-for-all. Looking back across the compound, Anya saw two men go down, apparently hit by friendly fire. By unspoken consent, she and Shingu both took off around the latrine shack's far end, running between it and the blazing Hummer. Their only hope of reaching their goal was speed. Once inside, they could take it from there. The shots raked Shingu's torso from the left, sending him sprawling on his face.
No!
Anya glanced back in an agony of indecision. She burned with desire to go back to help her wounded comrade, but that would doom her and the mission. She could not let herself die and fail.
Not dead yet!
Anya looked behind her once again as Shingu heaved himself up. The grin he showed her from his dark, handsome face would have carried more reassurance had it not been crimson with his own blood. The final shot punched through his temples from left to right. He fell on his face in the dirt. Anya sprinted for Publico's tent, letting her rifle drop into its sling around her shoulder. It was time for Publico to pay.
Anya, dearest girl, I've been waiting.
Publico stood at the back of the tent, casually, a smile upon his face. The only other person with him was a Brazilian soldier, most likely a high-ranking officer, judging by his intricate uniform. Sir Ian reached into an interior pocket of his linen jacket, producing a small object. It was blue plastic and shiny metal, and resembled an asthma inhaler. The colonel stared at Publico from across the tent. The color had dropped from his plump, dark olive face, leaving it ashen behind his beard and mustache.
What's that? Drugs?
Transformation.
8 men charged into the room and surrounded Publico. They were tall men, wide men. They were made even wider by the bulky, olive and earth-tone painted suits of bullet-resistant polycarbonate armor they wore. They carried curved polycarbonate shields on their arms and held yard-long shock batons in gauntleted hands.
Who are they?
My bodyguards.
Fat jiggling above his too-tight web belt, the colonel tried to force his way into the protective circle the armored men formed around Publico. They thrust him rudely back.
Sorry, Colonel. They're for me, not thee.
What? Please, Sir Ian.
The drugs always had that effect on Publico, filled him with a sense of invincibility. And as far as he was concerned, there was no reason they shouldn't. After all, in this case, his enemies were bringing everything he desired right to him. The colonel spun to his right as a horrified expression seized his face. His hand clawed at his holster flap. The colonel's throat burst open in a shower of blood, and he involuntarily spun to face Publico, who was just visible past the armored shoulders of his guards. The young man, at least 6'4 and built like a greyhound, stepped into the tent. His midnight blue bodysuit fit his muscle-rippling torso like skin. Chestnut dreadlocks hung about his shoulders. He held a Japanese-style short sword naked in his hand. Stepping over the colonel's shapeless lump of body and ignoring the huge armored guards, Patricinho's eyes fixed like golden spotlights on Publico's blue ones.
You are welcome, my friend.
Thank you for your hospitality.
Now, come on and die.
To Anya's shock, the guards forming the side of the protective circle closest to Patricinho stepped away, allowing him to enter. As he came face to face with Publico, they reformed their blockade.
Shall we?
Patricinio leapt forward with almost impossible speed, slashing at Sir Ian Moran with his sword. The big Irishman easily dodged the serpent-fast sword cut. Anya's eyes narrowed. No normal human could have evaded Patricinio's attack so fearlessly. Sir Ian was clearly being affected to his benefit by his chemicals again. On the far side of the wall of goons, Anya glimpsed blonde hair. Lys was shooting her electromagnetic rifle, trying either to chop a path clear or drop Sir Ian, their most vital target. But the big men just held up their Roman-style shields. The projectiles bounced off them as harmlessly as ping-pong balls. Three of the thick men charged Lys. She dropped her rifle. Publico darted in to rock Patricinio's head back with a fast, straight right. The Promason staggered back, blood streaming from his nose. Now it was Anya's turn. Shield to shield, two of the bulkily armored men advanced to meet her. She swung the sword overhand at the one on her right, figuring to break or even sever the man's shield arm. After a bit more than a foot, the blade stopped its penetration, failing to meet flesh or bone. Grinning behind the faceplate of his helmet, the man on the left had a big, brutal face. She thought to recognize either Gorin or Mladko. Which one didn't make a difference to her. He jabbed his stick toward Anya's ribs, barely missing. She pulled on the hilt of her sword to yank it free of the shield. It stuck fast. The plastic sides of the gash had gripped the flat of her blade as tightly as a vise. She released the sword and danced to her right. Gorin, as she chose to think of him, didn't have a lot of range, trying to reach around the big shield. He could not stretch far enough to hit her. Anya smelled ozone. She realized the batons were tipped with electric leads. If Gorin's had struck her, she would have received an incapacitating shock along with any other damage the blow might do. She stepped back to reassess the situation. Patricinio was still battling with Publico. The rock star stood with his head tipped forward, his lightly silvered dark blonde hair framing his face. Two other bodyguards were stomping something on the floor. To her sick horror, Anya realized she could no longer see Lys. The two men closest to Anya, having absorbed the fact that one way or another the woman in front of them was now unarmed, glanced toward each other and charged as one. Anya was fairly certain the second was Mladko. She lunged toward Gorin on her left. Turning sideways, she slammed into his shield. Taken by surprise, he rocked back onto his heels. Then he swung the shield outward with all his strength, hoping to fling her to her back, where she'd be helpless against a baton thrust. But Anya had grabbed his shield's upper rim with both hands and let all her weight hang from its inch-thick polycarbonate. Adding her weight to the momentum Gorin had imparted caused the shield to swing open to his left like a gate. Before an almost equally surprised Mladko could strike at her, Anya had swung past the business end of his baton. She found herself right between the hulks. With her right foot, she kicked hard at the back of Gorin's left knee. It wasn't a blow that could break the joint, but it did buckle it. Already overbalanced, Gorin dropped to a kneeling position. Anya got her feet beneath her, standing tall. She glanced quickly over her right shoulder to make sure none of the other bodyguards were trying to club or zap her from behind. But they had clearly been ordered to stay surrounding Publico at all costs, in case more would-be assassins turned up. Patricinio and Publico continued their death dance, oblivious to the world. For the moment at least, she was clear, and a moment was all Anya Creed needed. She let her weight fall back again, locking out Gorin's shield elbow. Mladko had turned toward Anya, thrusting his baton at her. It rammed against the inside of his partner's shield instead of her body. Gorin's armor could not prevent Anya using legs and hips to torque the shield. Mladko pulled his shield between himself and Anya, but she grabbed its top as she had his partner's. He was ready for that and braced himself like a rock. She was ready for that too. Jumping and pushing hard with her arms, she scaled the shield as if it were a solid wall. So strong was the polycarbonate that the cut she had made didn't open a millimeter. As she came over the top, Anya bounced a shin kick off the side of Mladko's head. His helmet took the force of the blow, but the move gave her the split second she needed to scramble astride his shoulders like a monkey behind his head. The man teetered in a circle, trying to reach her in her precarious position atop him, but the armor bound his joints. He slammed himself in the faceplate with the upper rim of his shield, stunning himself enough for Anya to catch hold of his baton right behind its live tip and use the leverage advantage to twist it from his hand. He had turned 180 degrees. Still riding Mladko's shoulders, Anya saw Publico lunge toward Patrocinio. Instantly, Patrocinio's blade flashed in a backhand slash for his enemy's eyes. Patrocinio was fast and skilled, but in the grip of his drugs, Publico was faster. He reversed motion, bending backward like a limbo artist. The short sword's razor edge came so close to his head that it sliced a small lock from the singer's mane. The outward cut left Patrocinio totally open to a retaliatory blow. Publico snapped forward and seized his foe. His right arm went beneath the Promason's left. His left hand caught the biceps of Patrocinio's outflung sword arm. With his right arm clamped up in an angle between his opponent's shoulder blades for leverage, Publico pushed back on the trapped arm with all his augmented strength. Mladko stopped ineffectually trying to bat at Anya, momentarily more fascinated by his boss's fight than his own seemingly comical predicament. Sensing the climax had arrived, the other guards had turned to watch their master's combat as well. And then Anya's vision contracted to a tunnel around Patrocinio's beautiful face, contorted with agony and effort as he still strove to break free. Reaching up behind Patrocinio's head, Publico grabbed a handful of his dreadlocks. Then with all his strength, he yanked down. Although the muscles stood out like columns on Patrocinio's powerful neck, his head was whipped back.
No!
Fury rose in a flood through Anya's body and mind. Reversing the sword, she drove it point downward toward where Mladko's thick neck joined the swell of his trapezius muscle. Through the neck hole of his armor, the blade plunged. Anya leapt free. As nimbly as they could, the guards to left and right sprang to form a new wall between her and Publico. Gorin had struggled to a sitting position, somehow managing to disengage his shield from his ruined left arm. He reached with his good hand for the gun holstered on his right hip. Anya reversed her sword, suspecting that the helmet was not thick enough to trap the blade, nor resist being neatly split by the powerful weapon. Three of Publico's remaining armored guards blocked Anya from the billionaire, who stood astride Patrocinio's corpse, grinning at her. Two others hung behind him, still guarding against reinforcements. Utterly absorbed by the events inside the tent, Anya wasn't even aware if the sabotage charges that the other team was supposed to set had detonated yet. She wouldn't have counted on reinforcements, had she been capable of thought. Anya fainted right, then lunged left. The men were big and strong and obviously practiced in their armor, but it still rendered them clumsy and disrupted their sense of balance. The leftmost man fell for Anya's feint and stepped forward with his left foot, committing his weight to it. Before he could shift his balance back, Anya ran past his right side, which was unprotected by his shield. She slashed backhanded at the small of the guard's back. One of the guards standing behind Publico charged past his master, drawing up his baton for an overhand strike. Anya tipped the blade of her broadsword back over her own right shoulder and thrust the pommel straight for the angry gray eyes behind the visor. Another guard charged from her right. She ducked under a horizontal swing of his baton and slashed him across his right shin.
Enough.
Anya wasn't ready to take Publico's word, but his two remaining men stopped in place. Even the man whose tibia Anya had just slashed rolled onto his side, coiling into a knot of agony. Sir Ian Moran had shed his jacket. His fight with Patrocinio had torn his shirt open, revealing his powerful torso. In his right hand, he held one of the long black shock batons. In his left, he held Patrocinio's sword.
I'll handle this from here, men. You want a piece of me, don't you, Anya?
What good do you think those weapons will do you? Whatever happens, even if you try to surrender now, I will kill you. I swear it.
Talk is cheap, dear girl. Cheaper even than your friends' lives. Show me what you've got.
If Publico had meant to taunt Anya into a blind, angry attack, he failed. In fact, she couldn't be any more focused. She took up an on-guard position like a modern fencer, left hand on hip, sword thrust toward his face. Anya withdrew her sword, coiling her legs for a real attack. She slashed low, aiming for his legs, but he spun toward her. He countered with a quick upwards cut, which Anya could only escape by flinging herself in a dive to her right. In one smooth motion, Anya rolled back into a standing position. Publico stood with his stolen short sword held out before him and his baton tipped negligently back over his right shoulder.
You see, Anya dear, at the end of the day, you're just an ordinary girl who's happened to luck into possession of a fascinating sword. You are an exceptionally resourceful girl, not to mention athletic and alarmingly skilled at combat, but still, just a girl.
Publico grinned a wild grin and launched a whirlwind two-weapon assault. He moved like a superhuman, but for all his speed and power, Publico had one very serious problem. His drug did nothing for his weapons. All she had to do was get an edge on one, and she'd chop it off like a skinny, dry twig. So he was forced to pull his blows unless he was certain they'd connect with either Anya or the flat of her blade. Like a skilled boxer, she managed to keep moving in a circle rather than backing straight away from him. She was fit and knew how to use her resources in combat. But if all she did was defend and give ground, he would sooner or later get lucky or just smash down her defenses. And she knew with terrible certainty that one solid hit would incapacitate her. Suddenly, Publico made an amateur's mistake. He fell into a predictable pattern, his timing becoming as regular as clockwork. Anya's blade flicked out.
Ah!
Sir Ian danced back with a red line across his left cheek that slowly blurred downward as it bled.
You're good, Anya. I'll give you that.
Publico rushed back, swinging his sword in a lightning-fast downward cut.
Ah!
The pain was bright as a camera flash, but she didn't let it distract her. Adrenaline quickly dulled its edge. Publico's days as a street-fighting man lay decades in the past. She'd been hurt in battle a lot more recently than he had. His minor success got him overconfident. Publico's blade severed, 2 inches from the round handguard.
Oh, well done.
Then he took up his own exaggerated fencer's pose, right side on to Anya. The contacts at the tip of the shock baton were aimed straight at her right eye. His left hand was held up behind him. She thrust toward his eyes, then thrust again, stopping short in a feint. With the prodigious strength of his wrist, he whipped the baton in a tight circle around her blade, outside to in. Then he knocked the hard sword to Anya's right, throwing wide her arm and leaving her open. Vulnerable as she was, a fast strike could have taken her down, but Publico raised the baton high overhead as if winding up to split a log. She got the sword up just in time, hilt gripped in both hands. The blow's incredible power drove Anya down. She had to use her back leg as a shock absorber, bending it until the knee touched the floor. Publico leaned far over her.
I knew you'd come, Anya, dear. And I know that everything I desired you'd bring to me. You wouldn't consent to surrender now and save yourself some pain?
Anya went limp. As Anya slumped to the floor, she thrust her left leg between his feet. Crossing her legs, she struck her right foot just to the outside of his right calf. Anya leaped to her feet. He had lost his shock baton. Sir Ian Moran lay on his back with his shoulders held just off the floor. His eyes were wide as they stared at the sword tip just 6 inches in front of them.
Why not finish it then, Anya? You were filled with self-righteous bloodlust a moment ago.
I can always kill you, but for now...
Anya turned towards the guards as one prepared to intervene to save his master, glaring harshly towards them but not removing her sword from Publico's face.
Stand back or I'll open his third eye!
Both bodyguards stepped back and raised their hands. The effect was almost comical, like cartoon robots surrendering. Like a rattlesnake striking, Sir Ian moved. His left palm slapped the sword away. His right hand plunged behind his back. He raised a taser, aiming it directly at her belly. Chained lightning flashed through Anya's body. The pain was unbelievable. Now unarmed, Anya fell to her knees. Sir Ian stood over her.
Call your lovely sword back, my love. I've got plenty of charges in this little beauty. And I do love to watch that lovely face when the current hits you. Not only do I get the hidden city with all its secrets, but I've discovered a beautiful woman running about the world fighting evil with a magic sword. How very sweet.
You can't believe everything you see.
Anya thought furiously, seeking a course of action. Nothing suggested itself. With Moran's enhanced reflexes, he would shock her insensible with laughable ease if she brought back the sword, nor did she think she was quick enough to rip the barbed contacts out of the skin over her ribs before he triggered the device.
Feel free to go ahead and kill me. Then you'll never get the sword.
In any event, I won't need to try any such desperate measures.
Two of the huge armored guardsmen shoved into the tent. They held Shea by her arms between them. Her long black hair had been torn loose and hung in her beautiful face. Her hands were bound behind her back.
Splendid work, gentlemen. The others?
Dead, sir.
Shea stared at Patrocinio's body. He lay sprawled on his back just a few feet from the man on her left. She raised her face slowly to look at Publico with chilling hatred.
Your lover? I'm sorry I had to kill him.
At least spare us the crocodile tears.
But you do me wrong, my dear. You see, I know you don't fear death. And I suspect you'd show the most wearisome resistance to torture. The martyr type, clearly. But you've a glaring weakness. Though I only have one of your friends captive, for now, it's only a matter of time before I capture more. As well as the city called Promise itself, with all its wonderful, wonderful secrets.
Anya looked sideways at Shea. Seeing her former enemy, now friend, so vibrant and resourceful, held helplessly captive by these thugs, broke Anya's heart. Shea caught her eye. She winked. Immediately, a sense of knowledge washed over Anya. Patricinio's body. She turned to look her tormentor in the face.
Torture's a lousy way to get actual information, Publico. Surely your intel pals have told you that.
Well, field research has confirmed what common sense told me. That a subject being tortured either says nothing, or tells her torturers anything she thinks they want to hear in hopes of making the pain stop. But when I torture this exquisite creature before your helpless eyes, cause her to suffer unendurably, not just for hours, but for days, for weeks. How long will you be able to bear her agony, Anya Creed?
Publico looked down at Patricinio's conflagrating corpse. The guard holding Shea's left arm gaped in astonishment. Then, glancing down, he saw that the left leg of his armor had caught fire. Blue flames raced up his side. He let go of Shea. Anya took violent, decisive action. Publico stared, utterly dumbfounded at the fiercely burning corpse of his foe, as Anya leaped to her feet. Holding the sword with both hands, she brought it up beneath the two wire leads of the taser. They parted with no more resistance than cobwebs. She spun in a circle just as he turned back toward her. Sir Ian Moran doubled over, his handsome face clenched like a fist in agony. Anya looked down into the blue eyes of Sir Ian Moran. They looked very surprised and very dead. Anya Creed sat back in bed with her knees propped up, tapping contentedly on her laptop. She felt as if she could lie in the air-conditioned comfort of the Belem hotel room forever. It had been a wild ride. Anya was not much of a TV fan, and if she ever had a reason not to watch, it was to avoid the media circus that was surely erupting by the minute. The aftermath of the chaos in the jungle would be one of the biggest stories of the year, if not just in Brazil, throughout the world. One way or another, she couldn't resist.
Just days ago, rogue elements of the Brazilian armed forces, apparently bribed by a renegade billionaire masquerading as philanthropist Sir Ian Moran, attempted genocide against a tribe of peaceful Indians in the upper Amazon. This crime against humanity was foiled when the aggressors fell to fighting amongst themselves. They killed their officers and Moran before surrendering to the indigenous defenders. High civilian and military officials are under arrest this hour in Manaus and Brasilia, while the U.S. has joined Germany and Russia in an emergency session of the UN Security Council. It is expected that the Council will be calling for a worldwide investigation into the so-called humanitarian empire of the man who called himself Publico. Back to talk about how the late rock star Publico's bizarre New Age beliefs led him to madness and mass murder. And how, ironically, he might have done a final humanitarian work greater than all the previous ones for which he had become so famous. Here to tell us about it is Dr. Frederick Mobutu of the World Health Organization.
Thank you, Tali. The Yarima tribe, whom Sir Ian nearly succeeded in wiping out, has just entered UN-mediated negotiations with the government of Brazil, along with a consortium of pharmaceutical companies. All access to their lands will be most strictly forbidden, but they will happily share the hitherto unknown and extremely potent medicinal plants Sir Ian Moran sought to take from them by force.
For a price, I assume.
To be sure. Royalties, it is predicted, will run to hundreds of billions of dollars within a very few years.
And I also assume that even before a penny is paid or a deal is fully in place, waves of lawyers have rushed forward to assist the victimized tribe.
That is also true. We might perceive a silver lining even in that, though, Charlie. Between the lawyers and all the media attention, there will surely be no further attempts, legal or otherwise, to steal the land and its treasures from its rightful owners.
Anya was filled with joy. The Promasons had done it. They'd finally found a way to get more of their secrets out to a needy world. It shouldn't surprise her, she realized. These were the same people, after all, or their descendants anyway, who had hidden combat training from their masters in a dance. Anya closed her laptop and put it aside. Her thoughts were jumbled. She knew she'd agreed to have her memory altered by the Promasons. She wasn't sure anymore what had been real or what she'd imagined. Still, she knew that she'd helped to accomplish something good, and that was the most important fact of all.
Hello?
Anya, sweetie honey?
Doug?
The network wants extra shows. They're starting back up early. I've been calling you for days and days. What'd you do, fall off the edge of the earth?
Something like that.
Rogue Angel, The Lost Scrolls is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2007, Alex Archer. Production copyright 2007, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, Michael Glenn, Terrence Aselford, Richard Rowan, David Coyne, Ken Jackson, James Konacek, Vanessa Benjamin, MB Van Dorn, Jeff Baker, Michael Replogel, Dylan Lynch, Christopher Graybill, Chris Rowan, Nathaniel Perry, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornette. Dialogue editing by Carlos Anderson, Brian Rogers, and Chris Rowan. Graphic audio sound design by Brian Rogers and Chris Rowan. The Rogue Angel theme was composed by Chris Rowan. Book adapted for graphic audio by Matt Jacobs. Additional German dialogue by Mark Ashby. If you enjoyed Rogue Angel, be sure to look for Simon R. Green's Deathstalker series, available at Roadstops Everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net. Keep listening for the next episode of Mark Dalton, Owner Operator.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
The First Mountain Man, number one.
Are we under attack?
Preacher put two bucks on the ground and tripled a third when he fired his pistol. Grabbed up his second brace to let them roar, but his left hand gun was a clean miss and his right hand gun misfired. Richard fired. The ball catching a brave in the stomach and stopping him cold. The missionary stood rock still for a second, stunned at the gore he caused. Preacher was on his feet, his long blade knife at the ready when a buck came tearing at him, a war axe in his hand. Preacher sidestepped slow from the axe and cut the buck across the back, from his shoulder down to his buttocks, the big blade slicing deep. The Indian fell and rolled on the ground, coming to rest near Penelope. Reaching out, he clamped one hand around her ankle. but Edmund picked up a rock about the size of a grapefruit and smashed the buck on the head. The creature jumped for his hawk and it cocked it, leveling the .54 caliber rifle just as the brave leaped out.
Reload, goddammit! Edmund, see to the horses!
Preacher dropped the rifle and hurriedly set to work trying to charge his pistols. Across the campsite, Melody spotted a brave leveling his bow.
Preacher, look out!
Preacher threw himself to one side and the arrow embedded itself into a tree. Preacher charged the lone brave and clubbed him with his pistol, smashing his head on the way down. Turning to check on Edmund, Preacher realized that the man had never made it to the horses. He was on the ground, unconscious, and a Blackfoot was grappling with Richard beside him. Richard was holding on to the buck's wrists. The Blackfoot kneed him in his groin and the man went down. Melody grabbed up a burning brand from the fire and jammed it against the engine's arm. The brave backhanded her in the face, knocking her down. Preacher leveled his pistol. The ball struck the brave in the head, tearing away part of his jaw and slamming the man to the ground. A young buck, armed with only a war axe, took a vicious swing at Preacher. Preacher clubbed him with the butt of his hawk just as another brave jumped onto his back. He tried to ride Preacher down, but the mountain man was able to flip the brave off his back. Buck hit the ground, rolled, and came to his feet just in time to receive the full length of Preacher's knife in his belt, cutting edge up. Preacher jerked the knife upward, the heavy blade ripping through stomach and into lung and heart. Blackfoot was dead before he stretched out on the cold ground. The fight was over.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.